Some words for meanwhile, January 19, 2017. There is only this way, this one way, to breathe while rain falls, finally falls and falls in Southern California, comes in repeated fits, storms over parched lands and lawns, pools at our doorsteps from overflowing gutters, sheets off pavements of parking lots, carves new rivulets in our gardens, our paths and trails. One way, while crews erect viewing stands in D.C., mile after mile of bleachers, media towers along the storied route, while in airports, passengers clutch boarding passes, eye podium monitors, while on basement floors and kitchen tables, women paint slogans, "Resistance is joy," pack boots, mufflers, and down jackets. D.C., Chicago, Tucson, Denver, L.A., will the buses make it? While they hope that nothing happens, knowing that nothing can mean anything now.
From the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio, this is host Lois P. Jones. Welcome to Poets Cafe. Lucia Galloway is a native Midwesterner transplanted to California, where she lives in Claremont, and co-hosts with Frances McConnell, Karen Greenbaum-Maya, and Genevieve Kaplan the Distinguished Fourth Sundays Reading Series. A co-winner of the Quill's Edge Press Chapbook Competition for her book, The Garlic Peelers, Lucia has also authored Playing Outside on Finishing Line Press and the full-length collection, Venus and Other Losses, published by Plainview. Her collection, Some Words for Meanwhile, is due from Future Cycle Press in 2019. Her poems appear widely in journals such as Comstock Review, Innisfree, The MacGuffin, Mid-American Review, Midwest Quarterly, Nimrod, The Sousier Spillway, and many others. Welcome, Lucia.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yay. It's great to have you here. This is such a big poem. It was written a couple days before the Women's March and after the inauguration of Trump. It was one of the largest demonstrations in recorded U.S. history. And the metaphor of rain speaks so much to me, to our thirst for democracy and of our real need, of course, for water in Southern California. And I was thinking about how Meanwhile carries this great deal of weight in your full collection. It's a kind of fulcrum on which the whole collection turns, really. So Meanwhile has the connotation of intervening time, but also simultaneously. So how did you come to this title? Because it really covers so much, and it's such a great title for your collection.
I came to it through this poem, really, because feeling the astonishment that many others felt after Trump was elected president and reflecting on this event of this march and some of that was a protest, really, against many of the statements that he'd made during his campaign.
Right.
I felt like we didn't really know what to expect. I felt like things might get a lot worse maybe before they got better. I wasn't sure what to expect. Mm-hmm. But I felt like in tumultuous times, we have to distill everything into the present moment as right. much as we can. We have to continue living. And so I wanted to put together poems that reflect on people's joys and sorrows and preoccupations and worries that continue no matter what is going on in the larger political scene, and that those things are treasures for us to have at hand and to engage fully.
That's right. It's sort of an affirmation of living, because meanwhile, while all this tumultuous chaos is going on politically with us and continues to go on with us. And we're still sort of in this meanwhile mode.
Like, and we will be.
When are we going to get out of this meanwhile? You know, meanwhile, well, that's happening. We have to live. And it's not only for us, but it's for the present generation and future generations.
Very much so. I very much feel that, especially now that I have several grandchildren. I feel that I have to do whatever I can to provide the resources that they need and the normalcy and the feeling of safety that they need in order just to proceed and be nurtured on a daily basis.
Exactly. So some of these poems reflect also on your Midwestern roots. And you said that there's a lot of prairie in your poems. You began writing after reading your father's journals, and which I understand, so he kept during his 1930s stint in the Panama Canal Zone and also after World War II. What was it about his writing that called to you as a poet? Did he write poetry too, right?
He wrote some poems, not a great many. He was really an excellent journal writer, and he wrote wonderful narratives of his life that he gave to my mother so that she would know something about his childhood and his youth. And so he was very good about that. He wrote poems. Many of them were for the Army Rag, as it were, the Army publication. They didn't make a terribly strong impression on me, but the fact that he had written some was significant.
Sure, your dad was writing poetry.
I can't really say anything specific about his poems. They probably were kind of occasional poems and reflective poems, and most of them were published, I think, in Army gazettes and so forth. But I really value his journal writings. And I do journal myself, so I picked up that habit.
Do you still journal?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
You know, I smack myself sometimes because I'm traveling or whatever. And when I do journal and then I look back at that, I go, oh, look at these details, you know. You think they're not important at the time, but then when you look back at them, you see how much they actually enhance your later writing. So
that's right.
Yeah.
You can mine them for wonderful, vivid details to put into the poems.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You have a great piece. If we can start with one of those other poems called Steely's. Would you read that poem?
Steely's. Taffeta sky, daft bees, marbles. And what had seemed a well-worked plot is fallow ground, ready for this story. Cat's eye, onyx, I draw my circle in the dirt. Always you are indoors, mother, sewing. Steady feet work the treadle, heel to toe, flickering, driving a rapier point through layers of cloth. The straightaway of long seams lets you speed ahead, needle whistling ditties. But circles of sleeve holes, collars, slow you. The needle labors, muttering, gingham, muslin, cousins. I keep your cousins' names, Mom, from your stories. Mabel, Earl, Harold, Jacob, May, and Lara. Names with oily surfaces, cirrus swirls of white and yellow round their roly-poly centers. I have my Aggies, Allies, Steelies, Turtles. I'm knuckling down, aiming my taw into the ring. Come out, see my dirty knees. Stitch me into the circle of your story.
Great. If you just tuned in, this is host Lois P. Jones, and we're with our wonderful guest, Lucia Galloway-Dick, and she's reading from her forthcoming manuscript, Some Words for Meanwhile. I love this poem, what you capture as almost like a tomboy girl. She's out in the dirt. You know, she's got her marbles and everything. I had to look up what a steely was. It's a marble made of steel, right? And then a taw is a large marble.
It's the shooter.
Okay.
And it is a large marble, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it makes, the poem makes such a distinction between you and the mother, you know, carrying on her duties as a wife, as a mother, inside, stitching. And somehow the daughter is not really part of that stitching in life. She wants to be more inside the story, I think.
Yes, yes. I felt that my mother was preoccupied with her cousins and her relatives to a very great extent. That was very important to her. Extended family seems sometimes almost as important as her immediate family. Mm. And I sometimes felt that. And your reference to the tomboy makes some sense, because sometimes I felt that my mother would have preferred to have boys, that she would have been a better mother to boys. And so when I read this poem in preparation for the show, I thought about that. That's a tomboy there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I did play marbles, but not continuously. I went through phases when I played marbles and learned, you know, how to play them from other friends. I don't remember the rules now, but
I played marbles too as a kid, and I remember just the fascination of holding them up to the light and looking at them. And you'd be excited when you got a new one. You
know, that's
you
right
to use it. Were both your parents aware of your writing? Did they come to know you as a poet?
No,
neither of them.
Neither of them really, because I did not write very many poems when I was younger. None when I was a child. I did write some essays and stories that appeared in various little venues and things. Mm-hmm. One was published somewhere. But I didn't write poems until I was in college. And then they may have been vaguely aware of it, but didn't really pursue it with me.
Okay. I would think your father would be, you know, sort of cued into that. Hey, my daughter's writing poems like I do.
My thing.
But the legacy is there. I think when parents expose their children to literature in whatever way it is, even when they're reading, you know, to them as young children.
I think so. It is true that my parents read poems to me from various books, from A Child's Garden of Verses, from a book of poems about Little Orphan Annie. There was a poem about that. Anyway, I was read poetry when I was a child, and I liked it. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about writing it until much later, though.
Right. You have another great poem in the book called For Girlhood that speaks to more of this background that we're talking about in the Midwest.
Yeah, this is a poem about later girlhood. I would say adolescence, really. For Girlhood. Near Albuquerque, wild rains sweep mesas in the dark. Satisfying to drowse aboard the night train in the dark. We cut a hole in the gazebo roof last summer, confident that fireflies and starlight would remain in the dark. Asters and watermelon laid the table on the old screen porch. Outside, I hear the pump handle strain in the dark. Norma, in her plaid sheath, is seated at the upright piano. Does she wonder which overtures to entertain in the dark? Lay the wild rose, violet, vetch, and shooting star between the pages of the press, their juices will stain in the dark. Stars and space, the great galactic sieve, too filigreed to hold without the stuff of burnt-out stars, cohesive vein in the dark. Hinged in two parts seemed the autumn moon one night, the dangling capsule of a construction crane in the dark. St. Lucy's Day, a crown of candles, coffee, saffron buns, small fires an early morning can contain in the dark.
Mm. For our listeners, this is a form called the guzzle. And it's an ancient form originated in Arabia in the 7th century. And I just love the music of it. It's not an easy form, I think, to do. You write a lot of forms. You write sestinas, you write sonnets, you write guzzles. What is it about form that free verse can't do? Why are you drawn to form?
I'm drawn to form because it offers the imperative to use certain words or certain constructions, and doing that can spring loose a whole lot of stuff that you never would have thought you could say, because you have to use a different kind of resources, and so your imagination can pull in a detail that will have just the right rhyme word or will be just the right thing for the length of stanza or the repetition that the form might demand.
Mm.
In my adulthood, I took a 6-week poetry course during a summer program with the poet Paul Muldoon.
Oh, sure.
And he would not allow us to
write. Oh, he loves form.
Yes. He started us all out writing forms and would not allow us to write a free verse poem until the end of this. And so I learned to appreciate it. And then when I was studying with Richard Garcia in the Antioch program, he also was very fond of forms, which I think he had picked up from some of his mentors. And so I had a lot of practice doing it, and I really enjoyed it. And I find that I return to forms at intervals when I can.
Had you written any forms before your workshop with Paul Muldoon? Paul Muldoon, for our listeners, was the editor of The New Yorker amongst his many accomplishments. He's a great poet. Many, many books. I've heard him read in person. I had a very brief workshop with him in San Miguel.
Wonderful.
And he loved form. I mean, everything that he read. Mm-hmm. So
yes, I think I did write a villanelle or two, maybe a sonnet before that. I can't remember exactly the time frame, but I do remember writing a villanelle to honor our middle daughter's marriage.
Mm-hmm. You really have to have a sensitivity to sound and to music. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, form really plays up the music of language so well. And in your guzzle, you have these repeated, that's part of the form, right? In the dark is the phrase that's repeated every other line. Can you tell me more about the guzzle? What are some of the constraints of it? Because I've always thought they're supposed to stand on their own as couplets. There's two lines, and they're supposed to be understood on their own.
Yes, that's true. They don't form a cohesive narrative. And in the one other constraint that I'll add is that in addition to the end phrase or word, which is repeated in every couplet, there's a word that occurs that must rhyme right before that recurring phrase, like train, remain, strain, entertain, and so forth.
Yeah.
So I have seen guzzles where the poet did not do that, but the tighter ones always use that rhyming word in connection with the phrase that must be repeated.
Yeah, so I think that adds to the music of it, for sure.
Once you start, you realize that there are all sorts of ways you can use this idea, and they bear perhaps some relationship to one another. Like, I think all of mine relate to sort of a kind of late adolescent experience or a young adult experience. And, oh, there's one other constraint. Mm-hmm. In the last couplet, the poet is supposed to use some form of his or her name.
That's right. Yeah, St. Lucy's Day you've included.
And, or refer to oneself in some way that people might be able to recognize, although, you know, like by a nickname or by a version of the name. And so I incorporate St. Lucy's Day. St. Lucy's Day is celebrated in the Scandinavian countries. Do you know, is it Sweden or Norway?
I don't know.
I'm not sure either. and St. Lucy is a young girl of the family who wears a crown of candles and wakes everyone up early on the 13th of December or 12th, I'm not sure which, with saffron buns and coffee.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, that would be a nice daily occurrence.
And, actually, of course, St. Lucy, that's named after Santa Lucia, St. Lucia, who was the martyred saint in the Roman mythology, is it?
Yes. If you just tuned in, this is Lois B. Jones, and we're with our marvelous guest, Lucia Galloway, and we're talking about form, and this is a particular form called the guzzle, which we've just discussed, and now we're going on to Assisi.
Traveling alone in Assisi. One. Light bisects narrow lanes when morning throws itself against signs and legends posted on walls at street corners. There is a saint whose city this once was. Now the city owns the saint, Francis, who turned from sure entitlement to cast his blessing on the birds and make himself a life among the poor. There must have been moments when he feared he could not compass this strange journey. Stranger to himself, winding through narrow streets, turning corners, opening onto vistas dazzling in new light. All this, Giotto and his lackeys captured in wet plaster. 2. Bare feet on cobbles meant closer to God. and Francis suffered on his once sound leg a suppurating wound from the stigmata that would not heal. Claire sewed a sock to cover it, made him a soft shoe so he could walk about the city that now owns Claire as well. The dimly lighted cases were on display, the linen alb and woolen cloak she wore on errands to the poor. Her bones rest in the crypt of Santa Chiara, its outer walls of Subasio limestone, pink and creamy white in the slanting sun. I could die here in this city of earth and ether, offer my flesh and bone to be housed here, slowly dissolve under stone the color of shells or the soles of children's feet.
That ending is just absolutely exquisite.
Thank you.
One of the great marks of a very fine poet is that you may not necessarily know the influence of their living or dead mentors, the people that they've studied, but you can feel them in this work. And afterwards, I understood that you spent time on NEH fellowships to study Whitman and Dickinson and later Wordsworth and Keats. Are they still some of the go-to poets for you that, yeah?
Very much so. Very mm-hmm. much so, especially Emily Dickinson. I go to her.
I could see that.
Yeah. People have said that they sense Dickinson in my poems. Mm-hmm. Keats, I love. I love to read his sonnets.
Oh,
Wordsworth,
yeah.
Perhaps not as much, but I've enjoyed studying all of those poets. In the first seminar, the one on Dickinson and Whitman, I really enjoyed the contrast between the poet of long lines and expansive, you know, imagination and Dickinson, whose imagination was extremely expansive, but it was all condensed
right.
in the moment, as it were,
yeah, right.
in the meanwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. One of the things I love about this collection is that it has me going off in varying directions. One of the things I discovered about St. Francis is that he had a love of troubadours. You may or may not know that. And then I thought, well, what's the female counterpart of a troubadour? So there was a troubadouritz. And this is, and I started
really?
To see all of these people from the medieval times also, women who were musicians and poets and usually of nobility that, you know.
Mm-hmm. I wish I knew more about Claire, St. Claire.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't absorb as much information about her, and so I can't say, but the building that's dedicated to her is beautiful, absolutely beautiful, church.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You were alone there.
I was. I had traveled there on a weekend trip from a castle near Siena where I was doing a writing retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And the weekends were free for us to travel. And they sort of wanted us to travel because there wasn't as much meal service and so forth. And so I got on a bus, an inner city bus, and went to Assisi, which I was really glad that I did, although it was really difficult getting back to find the bus stop and all. It was exciting and scary like a lot of travel is, especially if you do it alone.
Yes, I love traveling alone because of that and because of the reflective time that you get, because it seems like when you're with somebody, they always want to go off and do something else. And, you know, you get to spend time with things that are of real interest to you. So we're actually just now running out of time, and I wonder if you would please take us out with Dazzle.
Sure. Dazzle. After that cliff-hung moment, after the mica's glint, the taste of snow, when the birds had lapsed into silence, when they clung to winter-brittle branches, their summer nests long stolen, then you unfurled your wings, wove among clouds. Then you scattered feathers that we might yet find in your fledgling ascent a place to stay. And soaring above our alabaster loss, winsome, gorgeous, you dazzled us, and beauty complete was bittersweet.
Thank you, Lucia. Well, you dazzled me. and I'm very happy to have you on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is host Lois P. Jones, and our guest has been Lucia Galway. Thanks to our producer, Marlena Bond. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.